War. It's not the crisis, it's the Christie that is keeping people awake at night. Newspaper advertisement for Murder is Easy, 1939. I'm not very young, darling, and 3 years is a big gap. From a letter sent to Max Mallowan in December 1944. The years around the war, between 1937 and 1949, were the most fertile period of Agatha's writing life. A handful of her books had an emotional content, shadowed by their author's experience, which put them in a subtly different class. Death on the Nile, Sad Cyprus, Five Little Pigs, and The Hollow. Others have an unusual depth beneath the surface cleverness. Hercule Poirot's Christmas, Murder is Easy, And Then There Were None, Evil Under the Sun, N or M, The Body in the Library, The Moving Finger, Toward Zero, Taken at the Flood, and Crooked House. Within this period, Agatha also wrote her finest collections of short stories, Murder in the Mews, and The Labours of Hercule. Finally, she produced two superb Westmacotts, Absent in the Spring, and what is probably her best book of all, The Rose and the Yew Tree. It cannot be said too often, Agatha is a writer. To say otherwise is, as Poirot would have put it, to deny the evidence. Who else wrote so much? Blyton, Woodhouse, both of whom, like Agatha, created a world of solid artistic reality. At the same time, there is no denying that she was under intense pressure to produce books throughout the war. Her financial situation changed, and for a time she was effectively living hand to mouth. Yet this does not fully explain the insatiable creativity of her middle years, the brilliance of these books produced under duress, the fact that when she had a bare few days at her disposal, a precious holiday during the war, she completed Absent in the Spring. She had to write for money, but she also had to write. It was as simple as that. "Do you think of me as successful? How funny," says Henrietta Savernake in The Hollow. "But you are, my dear. You are an artist. You must be proud of yourself. You can't help being." "I know," said Henrietta. "A lot of people say that to me. They don't understand. They don't understand the first thing about it. Sculpture isn't a thing you set out to do and succeed in. It's a thing that gets to you, so that you've got, sooner or later, to make terms with it. And then, for a bit, you get some peace, until the whole thing starts over again." The way in which Agatha wrote, with apparent ease, and the kind of books she produced, mostly lightweight, have led commentators to take her extraordinary output for granted. But what she did was extraordinary, and although she herself did not choose to see it that way, it was the most important thing in her life. "One never saw that in life. She was so modest," wrote her friend A.L. Rowse. But her persona as a writer was something quite different, almost as if there were two personalities. Two, yes. Because Agatha wanted her ordinary life as well. She fed off it. She enjoyed it for its own sake. And it was essential to her writing, her drug in a way, since unlike most writers, she used no others. As Rowse wrote, "Outwardly she had a full and normal social life, family, two marriages, friends, hospitality, entertainment, housekeeping, at which she was very good, shopping, which she much enjoyed. All ministered to Agatha's life of imagination." Henrietta had learned the trick years ago of shutting her mind into watertight compartments. She could play a game of bridge, conduct an intelligent conversation, write a clearly constructed letter, all without giving more than a fraction of her essential mind to the task. In the 1930s, Agatha's life acquired a pattern that then fragmented into war, separation, anxiety, death. There was not the intensity of suffering she had known in 1926, but her determined joy of living might have been shaken had she not, in some inner part of herself, been insulated against reality. The easy answer is that her marriage had brought security. In fact, it was not quite that simple. More subtly, her marriage allowed her to be the person she had been when she truly felt secure. A child, in other words, whose imagination now roamed through adult hands and dealt in adult mysteries. There were real things in her past that she did not want to lose, but in the 1930s, they both quit the scene. Peter was immortalized in Dumb Witness, Brave Chien Va, and died the following year, 1938. My little friend and loving companion in affliction, Agatha had written to Max in 1930. You've never been through a really bad time with nothing in the world but a dog to hold on to. Peter had been her child, and later in a letter she remembered him jealously pushing between us. Max liked dogs, but Agatha adored them, for their goodness and loyalty, the qualities she valued above all others. Max also liked Ashfield, or so he had said in the early days. You need not worry as to whether I shall find Ashfield like home, for any abode will be home with you, and I shall like to think that you have not lost the older memories that you love. Yet Agatha was sensitive to Max, as she had not been to Archie, and she knew that he was uncomfortable with the weight of memory in that house. There were other reasons why she sold Ashfield at the end of the 1930s. Once it had been all countryside out of Torquay, she wrote in her autobiography. Three villas up the hill and then the road petered out into country. The lush green fields where I used to go to look at the lambs in spring had given way to a mass of small houses. No one we knew lived in our road any longer. It was as though Ashfield had become a parody of itself. Perhaps it would have been too painful for Agatha to see these changes inflicted upon her home. It had lived so powerfully in her memory. But when Max said, "You've been getting worried about Ashfield, you know," this was a coded message and she knew it. She sold. At the time, it felt like the right thing. But when the house was finally demolished in the 1960s, she cried like a child. "Sometimes I feel very homeless," she wrote to Max in 1944. "I find myself thinking, I want to go home. And then it seems to me I have no home. And I do long for Ashfield. I know you didn't like it, but it was my childhood's home, and that counts." She had bought a very different kind of house, Max's house as she called it, at the end of 1934. Winterbrook House at Wallingford, convenient for Oxford, described in Dumb Witness as Market Basing, was an elegant yet homely building, with a very lovely long garden that stretched down to the Thames. The facade was Queen Anne, close to the main road but screened by thick dark holly. The back of the house was Georgian. A staff flat and stables were 17th century, and there was a walled kitchen garden. The main bedroom overlooked the lawn, with its spreading cedar tree and deep, calm shadows. Max also had this view from his library, a double-length room, thick with cigarette smoke, comfortably piled with archaeological journals and volumes of Herodotus, the best gossip in antiquity, in Max's phrase. A.L. Rowse often went to lunch at Winterbrook, a cozy, warm, hospitable, upper-middle-class interior, as he wrote in his diaries, with all the comforts and amenities, the pretty china and good furniture that Agatha's prosperity had brought, that sunny house where the living rooms at the back look over their flat water meadows to the river. The essence of Middle England, like Wallingford itself, and surely the perfect home for Agatha Christie. But Agatha was about to acquire the house of her dreams. Greenway House, that magical white box set above the gleaming Dart. Greenway with its wild romantic gardens. Greenway rooted in its Devon history, and yet with its ghostly pallor, looking as if it might at any moment vanish into the air. "I sat on the seat overlooking the house on the river," wrote Agatha to Max in 1942. "It looked very white and lovely, remote and aloof as always. I get a kind of pang over its beauty. Too dear for our possessing. But what excitement to possess it. I thought tonight, sitting there, it is the loveliest place in the world, It quite took my breath away. The house she had dreamed into life at Ashfield, the river at the end of the garden, the vast unknown rooms that opened out from familiar doors, was now a reality. Agatha bought Greenway in 1938 for £6,000, an unbelievable sum, it would seem, equivalent to not much over £200,000 in today's values. But not everybody wanted to take on such a property, and its 33 acres. With the help of architect Guildford Bell, nephew of her friend Aileen, with whom she had stayed in Australia during the Empire tour, Agatha rediscovered the perfect Georgian proportions of her new acquisition. Wings had been added in 1815, but Guildford took them down, leaving the house symmetrical and exquisite. The main rooms opened out from a central hall, library, dining room, and sitting room, which itself led to a drawing room with long white windows giving on to a small secret lawn. The first floor had five main rooms, with a large handsome master bedroom and a vast lavatory with a wooden surround, the kind that Agatha favoured. Above were more bedrooms and a bed-sitting room for Rosalind. Behind was a complexity of servant quarters, a pantry downstairs, and a huge high kitchen ceiling. Everything was high, deep, rightful. Everywhere was secrecy, enchantment, mystery. A glamorous house on the grand scale, yet relaxed and full of ease, even if its beauty was too great for it to be a home of the kind that Ashfield had been. The original Greenway house was built around 1530 and destroyed, probably by fire, around 200 years later. Agatha kept notes on the history of her possession. Her mother had had a similar habit of scrawling down facts on scraps of paper. Named because of the Greenway across the Dart. Belonged to Gilbert family. Sir Humphrey Gilbert, discoverer of Newfoundland, born there circa 1537. His mother's second husband was a Raleigh, rebuilt 1780s. It was a famous house, like glorious Uggbrook near Exeter, where Agatha had met Archie Christie. It was her Devon past, where her soul lived. As a girl, she had seen it from the Dart. Clara had pointed it out to her. Now, it was her own. Agatha was too intelligent to take for granted that she was living in a house her imagination might have conjured. She tramped around the gardens, an overgrown tangle of rare plants that she and Max had begun to cultivate, and felt that she was indeed inhabiting a dream. She would write about this in later books, the place that seemed too beautiful to be real. It was there in Endless Night. The house isn't enough, you see. It has to have the setting. That's just as important. And in Halloween Party. If you wished, what could there not be? A garden for gods to walk. Yet in both these books, the desire to create beauty leads to evil. Beauty alone is not enough. It needs humility and warmth and humanity. But alas, there would be no garden blossoming on an island in the Grecian seas. Instead, there would be Miranda, alive and young and beautiful. Earlier, she had used literal representations of Greenway in Five Little Pigs and Dead Man's Folly, and in both books, it is the setting for a murder. One victim dies on the battery overlooking the Dart, another in the rather sinister boathouse. The house is portrayed as incredibly beautiful, although there is no sense whatever of Agatha's own relationship with it. It was a gracious house, beautifully proportioned, is her simple description of Nass House in Dead Man's Folly. Mrs. Follett went through a door onto the left into a small, daintily furnished sitting room and on into the big drawing room beyond. Precisely the configuration of Greenway. Nass House is the family home of the Folliats, and although the former lady of the house now lives at the lodge, she has a relationship to Nass that Agatha could not share with Greenway. Poirot comments on the superb and noble mansion, and Mrs. Folliat nods in a matter-of-fact manner. Yes, it was built by my husband's great-grandfather in 1790. There was an Elizabethan house previously. It fell into disrepair and burned down in about 1700. Our family has lived here since 1598. A part of Agatha envied Mrs. Folliat this casual grandeur. Mrs. Folliat of Nass House, daughter of a long line of brave men. She herself was more like a clever little detective, standing and gazing in half bewilderment. "It is a beautiful place," said Poirot. "A beautiful house, beautiful grounds. It has about it a great peace, great serenity." Agatha took a deep, quiet pride in having acquired this miraculous home by her own means. Yet she remained fascinated by those who did not need to buy, to work, to strive. Mrs. Folliat belongs at Nass House, as surely as the trees in its grounds, yet she is the same person living in the lodge as she would be in the big house. This was the idea at the heart of the Rose and the Yew Tree. It was nevertheless a sordid room. In the middle of it, sitting with her feet tucked up under her and embroidering a piece of silk, was Isabella. She and the room had, I felt, nothing to do with each other. She was here in the midst of it exactly as she might have been in the midst of a desert, or on the deck of a ship. It was not her home. It was a place where she happened just at the moment to be. As a child, Agatha had longed to be Lady, and now in a sense she was. Later she would become Lady Mallowan through her husband's knighthood, then Dame Agatha in her own right. Now she was mistress of Greenway House. But her idea of aristocracy was something different. It could not be acquired, achieved, or learned. This is the spell exerted by Isabella, the princess imprisoned in the ruined castle, over John Gabriel, the dynamic and brilliant man who falls in love with her. "I didn't want to be a common little boy. I went home and said to my father, 'Dad, when I grow up, I want to be a lord. I want to be Lord John Gabriel.' 'And that's what you'll never be,' he said. 'You've got to be born that kind of a lord. They can make you a peer if you get rich enough, but it's not the same thing.' And it isn't the same thing. There's something I can never have. Oh, I don't mean the title." The Rose and the Yew Tree is complex. It deals with class, but more than that, it deals with the mystery in human beings. In middle age, Agatha was still in love with the ineffable, the numinous. She grew older and coarser, grander and greedier, contented and assured. But her dreams did not change. Meanwhile, Max's life was going according to plan. After his season at Arpacaea, the first charge of his own dig and officially paid for by his sponsors, the British School of Archaeology, in 1935 he went with Agatha to Chaga Bazar in Syria. 2 years later, they also began to excavate Tel Brak, around 20 miles away. He worked alone, and his talents were given full rein, it was later said of him. Success followed success. To say the least, full charge of his workforce through the winter months, then home to Greenway or Winterbrook, or the new house that Agatha had acquired at 58 Sheffield Terrace in Kensington, the only house she claimed in which she ever had a designated room for writing. Yes, it was a grand life for young Max Mallowan. It has been said that he was not an especially good excavator, but he had other gifts. He had had the sense to keep his mouth shut and learn on the dig with Woolley, and now he had the confidence to take charge. "He played the role," says Joan Oates, who worked with him after the war. As might have been expected, he was a terrific handler of his workers. Arabs mostly, also Kurds, Turks, and Armenians. These were the days of cheap labour when as many as 200 men might be employed simultaneously. He was very good with the workmen, shouting at them. There was a strike at the beginning of one of the seasons. They wanted more money. And Max actually got up on a large wooden packing case and harangued them, and they all stood there, and in the end they all nodded their heads, and off they all went to work. I mean, he really enjoyed that. Agatha, too, enjoyed herself. She liked being at Chaga Bazar, says Joan Oates. She liked the flowers. If you look at the films she made on digs, they are full of wild flowers, which she had a passion for. She did indeed photograph fields of soft, luscious marigolds swaying in the wind. Also at Tal Brac, a little dog wagging its tail as it watched a lorry being laboriously unloaded. Yes, dogs and children and the lovely house they lived in at Chaga Bazaar. But the dig, no. Her interest was in being there, being the devoted wife, enjoying the countryside, which she did enormously. In a letter to Max written during the war, Agatha remembered Chaga Bazaar. That fresh, untouched feeling of the empty, smiling country. How lovely it all was. It was also often extremely uncomfortable, but Agatha was tough and healthy and always despised complaining women. In her memoir of life in pre-war Syria, Come Tell Me How You Live, she wrote of terrible heat, sudden rains that weighed as heavy as coins, nights spent in tents that looked drunken, a little out of true, meals swimming in grease, and sleep interrupted by mice across one's face, mice tweaking your hair, mice, mice, mice. I switch on a torch. Horrible. The walls are covered with strange, pale, crawling, cockroach-like creatures. A mouse is sitting on the foot of my bed attending to his whiskers. Horrible, crawling things are everywhere. Max utters soothing words. Just go to sleep, he says. Once you are asleep, none of these things will worry you. The endless difficulties, getting about the desert, finding accommodation, communicating with the houseboys and cook, sound frankly oppressive. But in her book, at least, Agatha's good humor is relentless. She also emphasized the joy of archaeology, the spell that bound her still. These autumn days are some of the most perfect I have ever known, she wrote of her life in 1935. Here, where nowadays only the tribesmen move with their brown tents, was once a busy part of the world. Here, some 5,000 years ago, was the busy part of the world. Here were the beginnings of civilization, and here, picked up by me, this broken fragment of a clay pot, handmade with a design of dots and cross-hatching in brown paint, is the forerunner of the Woolworth Cup, out of which this very morning I have drunk my tea. A different view comes across, however, in Death in the Clouds, which she wrote in 1934, probably while staying in Beirut, or Beirut, as she spelled it, en route to Syria. She allowed one of her characters to take a skeptical view of her husband's profession. As I look at it, an archaeologist is a poor kind of fish, always burrowing in the ground and talking through his hat about what happened thousands of years ago. Well, there they are, liars perhaps, though they seem to believe it themselves, but harmless. I had an old chap in here the other day who's had a scarab pinched. Terrible state he was in. Nice old boy, but helpless as a baby in arms. This, of course, would be reiterated by Nurse Leatherman in Murder in Mesopotamia, although in Clouds there is a trace of real contempt. In other words, despite the easy temper with which Agatha treated Max's colleagues, she was in fact noting every quirk of their behaviour. In Come Tell Me How to Live, she describes a young architect called Robin McCartney, Mac, whose air of taciturn superiority reduces her, she says, to a state of nervous idiocy. She makes polite conversation and is rebuffed at every turn. "I expect you'd like to explore the town," I suggest. "It's fun poking round a new place." Mac raises his eyebrows gently and says coldly, "Is it?" Agatha is portrayed as a socially inept twitterer, but in fact it is Mac who looks bad. Similarly with the odes that Agatha would later write on digs for members of the expedition. They were very jolly and clever and meant to amuse, but as Joan Oates says, there was often a sting in the tail with them. But Come Tell Me How You Live reads as if it was written to please one person, at least, her husband. It was a slightly manic style, as different as can be from that of her fiction, although in its way the book is equally artful. As with her letters, it has the air of a performance. What fun, Max! Oh, I am enjoying myself. She was not going to lose touch with him, as she had with Archie. That was for sure. She had a profound desire to make this a happy marriage. The power in it was hers, but so was the willingness to please. And she wanted to prove to Max how much she enjoyed sharing his life. She did have a genuine love for the East and a genuine liking for some of Max's colleagues, from whom she could, if she chose, withdraw herself mentally. Perhaps the greatest attraction of all was that, when the pressures of her life in England grew too much, she could simply jump ship and escape every year. "Mrs. Mallowan is in Syria, Iraq," became Edmund Cork's constant refrain when asked if Agatha would appear on the BBC, or answer a mad fan letter, or allow an amateur playwright to adapt one of her books, or agree to Miss Marple appearing on American television. It was another layer of protection. On the dig, she was not Agatha Christie, she was not even Agatha. She was Mrs. Mallowan, wife of the man in charge, the smiling figure who kept to the background and kept life sweet. Yet the impression given by her book that she devoted her every waking thought to Mesopotamian pottery is false. She did a good deal of writing in Syria. She had her little typewriter and her blissful solitude. As war in Europe drew near, as the dogs barked and the workmen shouted, "Yalla, yalla!" she sat at her sharp-lit table in the desert and dreamed into life the world of murder is easy. England, England on a June day with a grey sky and a sharp biting wind. And then, September 1939. Agatha was at Greenway when war was declared, and she realized that her delightful life would be put on hold. There was not the desperate anxiety of the first war, when Archie had been on active service, although now she understood what he had gone through. But there would be upheaval, deprivation, loneliness, and remarkably, a creative outpouring of work of the very highest quality. Agatha was almost compulsively occupied during this period, which sat at the center of her life and was as important in its way as the years around 1926. The last book she wrote before the war was Sad Cyprus, the somber story of love and loss. Eleanor cannot live without Roddy, but Roddy has fallen for Mary. "Tell me honestly," says Eleanor, "do you think love is ever a happy thing?" To which her dying aunt replies, "To care passionately for another human creature brings always more sorrow than joy. But all the same, Eleanor, one would not be without that experience. Anyone who has never really loved has never really lived." The girl nodded. She said, "Yes, you understand. You've known what it's like." Eleanor is a cool, aloof creature who hides her feelings, while Jacqueline de Belfort, in Death on the Nile, is an impassioned little hotblood, but they are sisters under the skin. Hopelessly in love with men who cannot quite return their feelings. Jackie loves Simon Doyle, who is dazzled by the rich and glamorous Lynette Ridgway. Jackie behaves badly, makes a public spectacle of herself. Lynette complains to Poirot, who says, "There are times, madame, when pride and dignity, they go by the board. There are other, stronger emotions." Poirot has an intense sympathy for both Jackie and Eleanor. He is on their side. When Simon, in the authentic voice of Archie Christie, asks, "Why can't Jackie take it like a man?" Poirot says, "Well, you see, Monsieur Doyle, to begin with, she is not a man." In Sad Cyprus, Eleanor says that she has always loved red roses, while Roddy preferred white. And that, says Poirot, is the difference between them. It explains Eleanor Carlyle, who is passionate and proud and who loved desperately a man who was incapable of loving her. Poirot does not approve of murder. He says so all the time. Yet he feels for these women. If despair has blinded them to morality, he will not condone, but he will understand. Then there is Bridget Conway in Murder is Easy, thrown over by a man who she loved so much that it hurt, and Vera Claythorne in And Then There Were None, who murders for the love of a man. So you did drown that kid after all. There was a man in it, probably. Was that it? Love, as the doctor says in Sad Cypress, is the devil. He himself is in love with Eleanor, who is on trial for the murder of Mary Gerard. She might have done it, yes. I don't care if she did, he says to Poirot. I don't want her hanged, I tell you. Supposing she was driven desperate. Love's a desperate and twisting business. These were the books, interspersed with more straightforward fare, like 1-2 Buckle My Shoe, that Agatha was writing before the war. And in 1942 came the best of them all. Five Little Pigs, the story of Caroline Crail, whose painter husband Amyas takes his beautiful young model Elsa as his mistress, is not that of Agatha's first marriage, but it is perhaps the closest she came to telling it, in her detective fiction, that is. It has an intimacy, a felt quality. It gives a very real sense of the disrupted household, the quarrelling couple, their neglected daughter, and the governess, who is totally loyal to Caroline. I'm a very primitive woman, Caroline says. I'd like to take a hatchet to that girl. Meanwhile, the girl Elsa tells Amyas Crail that his wife should let him go. If she loved him, she'd put his happiness first, and at any rate, she wouldn't want to keep him if he wanted to be free. To which he replies, Don't you realize, Elsa, that she's going to suffer? Suffer? Do you know what suffering means? Five Little Pigs is a masterly piece of writing. Its motivations are complex, intertwined, and, in their resolution, entirely satisfying. At the center of the book is the relationship between art and real life. Amyas sees the world differently from his wife and mistress. Like Vernon Dyer in Giant's Bread, he sees it through the prism of his art. With women, love always comes first. Men, and especially artists, are different. So says Poirot. But Agatha was a woman and an artist. She understood the artistic sensibility, the fact that Amyas Crail has fallen in love not with Elsa herself, but with the subject of his painting. At the same time, she understood Elsa, the depths of her feelings for the real man, and of course she understood Caroline. In this book, as in Giant's Bread, she set the claims of art against those of ordinary life, and was able to give them equal weight. Rare stuff for a book that also works on another level entirely, fitting the template of the detective novel as neatly as a lid on a jar. In fact, Five Little Pigs has a fair claim to being Agatha's finest. Its chief rival is The Hollow, which, through the character of the sculptress Henrietta Savernake, has a similar central theme. But what an extremely complicated woman Agatha was. Because even as she was shaping these really quite beautiful books, which were both perfect geometric puzzles and perfectly distilled meditations upon human nature, even as she was writing back into life the memories of lost love, even as she was letting the shadows of the past drift across her imagination, even as she was dedicating Five Little Pigs to another man, so at the same time, she was writing to Max Mallowan like an eager little girl, telling him how much she was longing to see him again. Oh, Max. Max, for whom the war came as a wretched interruption to his career, seized the opportunity to obliterate the fact of his lineage by serving his country. His father's Austrian military career hampered him in his early attempts to get war work, as did his age, 35. And at first he joined the Home Guard at Brixham, near Greenway. One of my companions in arms, he wrote to Rosalind, is Professor of Greek at Bristol University. Our experience of Hellenic warfare is second to none. Not until 1940 did he find occupation, helping to organize an Anglo-Turkish relief committee. In 1941, after constant pressuring of the authorities, he joined the Air Ministry with his friend, the Egyptologist Stephen Glanville, in what became the Directorate of Allied and Foreign Liaison. Finally, in early 1942, he got a job that made use of his abilities. He went to Cairo as a squadron leader, there to establish a branch of the Directorate, moving to Tripolitania in 1943 and working in administration. As an Arab linguist, he was very useful. He ended the war number three, as he put it, on the civil side out here, and attained the rank of wing commander. Administration is probably rather bad for one, and you would say I am getting pompous. He wrote to Rosalind at the end of 1944, but I try not to be. In fact, he enjoyed the work. I know that I am doing a man's job, pulling my weight and not wasted, he wrote to Agatha in October 1943. It has been a leavening for my life, which always tends to take the easy path. He was, nonetheless, very nicely set up. At first he shared a flat with his brother Cecil, who coincidentally was in Egypt. I often imagine you sitting here, he wrote to Agatha. One particular armchair is yours. Do you eat as much as I do when you are alone, or are you wasting away? Then in Tripolitania, he lived in a house on the sea, a beautifully built Italian villa, which by comparison with England at that time must have sounded like heaven. Who likes the sea? I do. Oh, the unfairness of life, wrote Agatha. My room, wrote Max, is snug and cozy, and somehow it has become full of books. Rather charmingly, he added, that is what you have done for me, given me a feeling for making a room homely and comfortable. Meanwhile, in 1942, Greenway had been requisitioned by the Admiralty, and Agatha was braving the bombs in London. Not that Devon had been much of an oasis. In September 1940, she wrote to Edmund Cork that, we had a good invasion scare last week. How swarming with soldiers so dressed up they could hardly move. She also had coped briefly with a number of evacuated children, two of whom came under fire from a fighter plane when sailing on the Dart. It seemed reasonable for Agatha to join Max in London. Cresswell Place and Camden Street were let. Sheffield Terrace was bombed in October 1940. Despite Agatha's giant property portfolio, she became itinerant, living in Half Moon Street, then at a service flat in Park Place, then in the Bauhaus block at Lawn Road in Hampstead, whose windows were broken by a blast in 1940. But how odd, Agatha wrote, to think that as I pass a funny old building like a liner, I shall always look up at it and say to myself, I was happy there. No beauty to speak of, but, oh, darling, I did have so much happiness there with you. She stayed at Lawn Road Flats for much of the war. It might seem an unlikely setting for cosy, chintzy Agatha Christie, with its contemporary philosophy of designed living in near-identical flats. But Agatha was a more daring creature. She rather liked her fashionable block. She took little part in the life of the Isobar Dining Club, something of a social centre during the war, also used as a bomb shelter, although she would occasionally go down in search of company. She liked to be near Hampstead Heath, where she walked the Psyllium James that she had semi-appropriated from Carlo Fisher. She also enjoyed the convenience of living in a furnished flat, found the modernist Isocon long chairs strangely comfortable, where tenants were looked after by the management. Will you please look into the question of these knickers which have not been returned? They wrote on Agatha's behalf to the local laundry. If they have been lost, send Mrs. Mallowan the necessary coupons. Some years later, she recalled that her chief memories are of the fascination of finding a place where, like the wood in Dear Brutus, trees really seemed to have moved close up to the windows. That meals in the garden and one particular beautiful white blossoming cherry tree are the things I have never forgotten. No wonder her possession of Greenway seemed barely real. She had lived there less than 2 years before clearing it for the Admiralty. My heart sinks, darling, at the thought of more turning out, packing, etc. However, I hope I shall have Roz to help me. Run her down there by the scruff of the neck, if necessary. It makes me quite tired to think of all the work you have done moving, wrote Max, and that devil Rosalind mainly thinking of how to unlock the Tantalus. It was a huge job. The two garden boys have been a godsend. They practically never see the garden, but live in the cellar carting up dinner service and silver. It was in such an awful state that I started to clean it. she wrote in October 1942. Then, 2 weeks later, "Goodbye to wonderful Greenway. I have used the last colour film so that we shall have a remembrance of it in case anything happens." In fact, the house was in very good hands, those of the officers on an American flotilla, who treated it with great respect and painted a blue and white frieze around the cornices of the library ceiling in memory of their wartime exploits. And London had its compensations, friends, theatres. Agatha had a large acquaintance, the Honourable Dorothy North, Sybil, Lady Burnett, Alan Lane of Penguin Books and his wife Lettice, Max's colleague Sidney Smith and his wife Mary, Max's friend Stephen Glanville, and she maintained a determinedly active social life. She went to the ballet, seeing contemporary productions like Robert Helpman's Hamlet, and she indulged her passionate love of Shakespeare. In 1942, she saw Othello at the Old Vic. This provoked a long correspondence with Max, who announced his intention of reading all the plays, a task he gave up halfway through. Agatha's attitude towards Shakespeare was an interesting one. It was typical of its time, but it was also typical of her. She saw his characters as psychological studies, looking for clues in the poetry rather than viewing Hamlet or Iago as an unparalleled accretion of words and rhythms. Iago, in particular, obsessed her. For Agatha, he was a fixed entity, almost a reality. She took little account of the way the pressure of the play magnifies his initial intent, but her analysis of what she saw in the character was brilliant. "Iago suffered, poor devil," says John Gabriel in The Rose and the Yew Tree, who understands exactly what it feels like to hate the human being who's up amongst the stars. In his case, Isabella, in Iago's case, Othello. Iago features too in Curtain, where he is described as the perfect murderer because he instills in others the desire to kill. Poirot, in the voice of Agatha, says this: "I have always been of the belief that already present in Othello's mind was the conviction, possibly correct, that Desdemona's love for him was the passionate, unbalanced hero worship of a young girl for a famous warrior, and not the balanced love of a woman for Othello the man. He may have realized that Cassio was her true mate, and that in time she would come to realize the fact." This is terrific stuff, true to the spirit of Shakespeare, whose poetry allows characters to be and feel more than one thing at the same time. What she wrote in August 1942, after her visit to the Old Vic, was closer to the Freudian school of literary criticism. "Iago and Amelia are really a couple of common swindlers or confidence tricksters. That is borne out, I am now being Hercule Poirot, by the opening of the play when Iago enters with the present fish that he is playing and Rodrigo is saying, 'Thou, Iago, who hast my purse.' On this theory, where comes Iago's intense hatred of the Moor? I think that plain sexual jealousy is the crux. He has suffered through Amelia again and again. The joy of seeing Othello suffer as he has suffered, and finally the sex maniac's suggestion strangle her. That is what he would like to do, but hasn't ever had the courage." Later, Agatha discussed Ophelia, offering to Max the real aperfu that Shakespeare, with his female characters, was feminine enough himself to see men through their eyes. She then asked the impossible question, why does she go mad? A little later, she believed she had her answer. After a performance of Henry IV, Part II, she dined with Robert Graves and met a friend of his, a doctor. "I said I found Ophelia the most difficult to understand." He said, "Oh no, you would find Ophelia in any schizophrenic ward of a mental hospital." Agatha was, at this point, almost in love with Shakespeare. "I cannot think of anything else." By comparison, she found Greek drama disappointing. "What astounds me in these dramas is the lack of any ideas or concepts, an opinion that would not have gone down well with Max." Shakespeare's sonnets featured in The Moving Finger and Absent in the Spring. "From thee have I been absent in the spring," while the title of Taken at the Flood is from Julius Caesar. Later, she hinted at a Lear reference, with the name Edgar in They Do It With Mirrors, and used Macbeth as a base for the plot of The Pale Horse, which also contains an inspired disquisition on how the play should be staged. By the pricking of my thumbs is, of course, a direct quotation. In a letter to Max, she imagined the man himself. "I don't believe he had much what you call personality," she wrote, which was true of Agatha herself. "A quiet little man, I see him, rather vain, eaten up with longing to play the lead, but with some disability. Did he stammer?" She pictured him drinking in the tavern with Ben Jonson and the rest, not saying much, then leaving. And in the tavern, they wouldn't notice he had gone, but he would walk home in the moonlight with words singing and dancing in his head, lovely sequences of them, and he would see them being said on stage. "Why aren't you here to talk to?" Max was impressed, perhaps a little surprised by Agatha's knowledge, which has the slight air of being offered to a teacher for approval. In February 1943, he wrote to suggest that she write a short and simple book on Shakespeare the man. "You have the imaginative penetration of the writer, and creative artist yourself, and the solution of the many problems in his life and his work is partly, if not largely, detective work. So put old Poirot on the job and get down to it. If you want any help on the scholarship side, I will do what I can to keep you on the straight path." If this struck Agatha as condescension, she showed no sign of it, nor did she accept Max's suggestion. "No, I couldn't write a book on Shakespeare. All my remarks are just Mrs. Pupa and for you only." She and Max addressed each other in private as Mr. and Mrs. Pupa. As with most intimate nicknames, the origin of this is unfathomable. She was annoyed when Max's mother told her that she should deploy her talents in writing more serious books, like biographies. Yet Max's remarks about her work, which occasionally verge upon interfering, seem not to have bothered her. He was not jealous of her success, and in this he was probably unusual. Most men, Archie, would have found it difficult to act as consort to a woman of Agatha's renown. "Well, Max was very conceited," says Joe Notes. "But his self-assurance also made him competitive. He liked to assert his opinions, the worth of his own work, his claims to the intellectual high ground. This, for example, was the critique that he sent of The Murder at the Vicarage back in 1931. "Ainge, I think you are terribly clever. I think my only objection to the story is that it was too clever. I think your manner of writing is perfectly adapted to a detective story, because one forgets the printed page and is transported straight into real life, and breezy life at that, rather like a whiff of Ainge, and one feels that the narrative and conversation is all spoken and not written. Exactly as it should be, it seems to me. I understand now why you don't bother about semicolons. Well done." Later he took Agatha to task for a grammatical error in Five Little Pigs, which he nonetheless considered to be in a class with some of her special masterpieces. If only she had not used the word like as a conjunction. "Wrong. He doesn't know him like I do. Right. He doesn't know him as I do." This is a very usual mistake to make, but you see, I read it carefully and enjoyed it. In fact, as she told him, he had read it already in manuscript. In his next letter, he praised Dorothy L. Sayers' Murder Must Advertise, which he was reading and loving for its highbrow style. Agatha fired back, telling Max that she had been typing in his library at Winterbrook. "Heresy! Lowbrow stuff in the highbrow sanctuary of Mr. Pupa." But on the whole, she took absolutely no notice of her husband's patronizing tone. Indeed, when it came to her work, she took no notice of Max whatsoever, and almost nothing of him appeared in her writing. Only with "Come Tell Me How You Live" did she seek his opinion. This, after all, was his territory. Max read the manuscript at the end of 1944. "I confess, at first I thought it might be a shade embarrassing to publish such a book, and perhaps there is rather a lot about us in it. but I don't think it matters, really. And the main thing is that it will, I believe, give pleasure and amusement to quite a lot of people. Also, it is perhaps better that it should come out now, during the war, than when I am actively at work, digging. Max then told her that she had become a very good writer. I mean, descriptive writer, quite apart from your graphic conversational style, at which you were always an adept. There are, of course, a number of mistakes, or rather misspellings, in the book, on which I must try and send you a special letter tomorrow. Muhammad is consistently misspelled, and should be Muhammad throughout. Agatha wrote to Max how much she had loved writing the book, so much so that it had been an almost painful experience. "I've been living all those days over again, and now it's like waking up in a cold and lonely world. What did I do before you were there?" Living without her husband for more than 3 years, the buried fear of being alone and abandoned came to the surface, and the shared past became hallowed. Their letters are full of exchanged memories. "I am doing a lot of writing just now. It's going well. But when I am tired and my back aches, I would like to find a cushion and put it on your lap and lay my head on it, as I used to do long ago at Cresswell Place. Do you remember?" In turn, Max wrote, "I like to think of you with the woolly Jaeger's dressing gown I gave you before leaving England. Do you use it often? My woolly bear. Do you remember the woolly bear coat you were wearing in the cab at Baghdad that day in March? Was it when we were on the way out to dig at Arpakea?" More than once, he reminded Agatha of an evening at Lawn Road when she was ill, and, "I cooked a meal while you issued instructions from the bed. Great fun that was." He also hit an occasional lyrical vein, a legacy of his youth, perhaps, when he had written the occasional, rather laborious poem. "Odd things that come back to me. Planning the garden at Greenway, sitting under the limes and looking over the green lawn at Wallingford. My books in the library. Talking archaeology. These are only a few of the things that flash across my mind like the yellow marigolds that are specially yours, gleaming in the sun. What I treasure in you is your imagination that has been a continual stimulus to me, needful to the scholarly side. Your love and affection, without which life is a drab thing. Your enthusiasm, freshness and vitality. Your capacity for sharing my interests and enjoyments." This was a wonderful thing for Agatha to read. That Max appreciated in her all the things that Archie had shunned. "I am so glad that you can write that to me, darling." Her insecurity was almost palpable nonetheless. However much Max reassured her, the fact of physical separation unnerved her. Perhaps she remembered what had happened when she spent those weeks at Ashfield sorting through her mother's things. "Oh, darling, I hate these November days," she wrote in 1942. "I want to be with you. I feel so afraid sometimes that we shall grow outwards." She drew two lines moving apart, instead of a nice parallel track. "Think of me a good deal, please, and write often, because I need cheering when there are no sunny days." Small wonder Max had confidence in himself. This woman had given him so much, yet she was the supplicant for his affections. He could write to her, "Of course, use our joint account for anything you want, and get away with it." He could count on the fact that she would visit his mother, and subsidize her through the joint account, even though Agatha and Marguerite were now rather ragged with each other. "I was very tired when I went there, and your ma's criticism of England got me on the raw, and I flared up. I dare say it will all blow over. Don't be cross with me. I really have been very nice all these years."
"Hope you will try and patch it up," he replied.
He could answer in all seriousness when Agatha asked his opinion as to whether she should accept an offer of £4,000 for Winterbrook, pretending that the decision was in any way his to take. He could tell Agatha to write more legibly. It was true that her handwriting sometimes resembled hieroglyphics. To number her letters, "Lazy pupa," he wrote when she forgot.
to consider a certain actress for a part in one of her plays because he happened to know the girl's fiancé. This Agatha only pretended to go along with. To remember when she dramatized her books, not to make the detective part of a play too difficult for the man in the street. He could do all these things because he had the power to make Agatha happy or unhappy. Sometimes he reveled in this. "Wouldn't you have been a very foolish Mrs. Pupa if he hadn't married me? And aren't you pleased you did? And do you remember how A.P., Madge, tried to dissuade us, and what a foolish thing that was to do?" he wrote in February 1945. Yet there can be no doubt of their real closeness. "In many ways we are so unlike," Max wrote in March 1943, "but our hearts are the counterpart of each other." For their different reasons, each wanted the marriage to work. Their private world together had therefore been a careful construction, not an evolution, but for that reason, it was all the more solid. In March 1944, Agatha conjured it to express her longing for Max. "Sometimes my need for you is worse than others. It's a feeling like an ache in one's middle going round and round. Do you ever feel like that? Or is it purely a pupa reaction? I've had all sorts of dreams of you lately. Really very erotic and rude ones. Extraordinary, after all the years we've been married. I wouldn't have believed it. Nice, except that it's annoying to wake up. I miss your nice, coarse conversations, too." "Yes, Pupa dear, I do miss you a great deal," Max replied. "But the corkscrew motion you speak of is definitely a pupa motion. With me, it is a feeling of emptiness, of being unfilled. Not unlike being hungry, I want to eat and hug Mrs. Pupa. But then one fine day that will happen, and there will be a great deal of wagging of tails continuously. I'm glad you miss nice, coarse conversations. I have plenty of that saved up for you. Rude Mr. Pupa." This was what Agatha would have thought of as being herself. "You do love your funny pupa as she is," she wrote. She could tell Max to think of your porpoise pupa every time you were in the sea, and write about eating so much she almost burst, knowing that he would not shudder in horror. Similarly, she wrote to him about the joy of their reunion. "What lovely times we shall have when we are together again, and how we shall eat! There will be your socks with holes in them, and things strewn everywhere, and chairs covered with books, and a lot of laughing. And we will talk and talk and talk. And you will pick your nose, and I shall yell at you, and you will say pupa to me very sternly when I..." This was a long way from the slender fairy girl who had married Archie Christie. Between those two, there had been the mystery of physical allure, which Agatha still conjured in her books but had deliberately destroyed for herself. She had indeed coarsened. She did not merely hide being the public persona of Agatha Christie. She sheltered within a shroud of flesh, dense and unwieldy, a symbolic defense against the sharp agonies of the past. Her fatness also made her sad, although she made light of it. She described in Come Tell Me How You Live the embarrassment of trying to buy clothes for the Syrian heat. "Oh no, madam, we do not keep out sizes." And of being asked by Max to sit on their overfilled trunks. "If you can't make them shut, nobody can." But she had grown resigned to the loss of her looks, and she truly loved to eat. She also loved the fact that she could do so with Max, who had been thin when they met. "That was before I fattened him up," she told Joan Oates, but who now described himself as an awful gormandizer. It was childlike behavior again, in a way. The gleeful tearing away of adult protocol. It was the equivalent of the absolute relaxation she had felt at Ashfield, lying beneath the beech tree, knowing that Clara was somewhere nearby. "The years we have had together have been the happiest of my life since I was a child. But no man could ever be quite what Clara had been." At times, Max's letters became far less frequent. In October 1943, he went on leave and did not write for a month. You are a dirty dog. I can see your face saying, "Naughty Mr. Pupa." And then I should have to laugh if you were here. You are not really contrite. You just know you can make it all right. In July 1944, she was unable to stop herself writing repeatedly. Still no letter from you. Damn your eyes, or damn somebody's eyes. 3 days later, it's hell not hearing from you. What are you doing? And 4 days later, please, darling, don't leave me without a word. I know you get lazy fits, but just a word or two would do. I feel very guilty, dearest, at my lapse in not writing to you, he wrote eventually. She had tried to be sanguine about what Max might do, left so long to his own devices. I ought to be able to share your leave, she wrote in October 1943. Have a good time, darling, and do anything you want and that you need, just so long as I am held in your heart in deep friendship and affection and very close. But in 1944, she tried to get herself sent out east. When exactly do you get your 2 months' leave? She asked several times. I still think it possible that I might do a writing job in Egypt. This plan did take tentative shape. Prospects of the Middle East, good, she wrote in August, although Max did not encourage it particularly. I think I ought to get home first, for as you know, my time is up at the beginning of April next year, he replied. Then in September, you don't want to risk getting stuck out there for a long time and Mr. Pupa back in England and you in Egypt. This was undeniable, although Agatha might have preferred it if Max had been desperate to see her immediately. She would not be reassured until they were in the same country. I had a horrid dream that I had come to visit you somewhere abroad. They told me that you no longer cared or wanted me, and had gone away. And I woke up in a panic and had to say over and over, "It's not true, it's not true, I've got his letter." The terrors of 1926 did not go away. This desperation was odd, as Agatha wrote about it at a time when her friendship with Stephen Glanville was deepening in intimacy. Stephen was 10 years her junior, and had been a friend of Max since 1925. An intellectual through and through, his career as an Egyptologist had taken him first to the British Museum, thence to London University, then back to Oxford, where he had taken his degree. He served in the Air Ministry during the war, working in Whitehall and living in Highgate, near Lawn Road Flats. After the war, he took up a professorship at Cambridge. It is a testament to his abilities and popularity that he became the first Oxford man to become provost of King's College, a position to which he was unanimously elected in 1954. A person of great substance, he nonetheless had a gift for lightness. Like Agatha, he had a joy for living. He was bespectacled, not handsome. He had an immense charm and was attractive to women. It was said of him that Stephen fell in love with every woman he met. Certainly, he was unable to resist a close friendship with somebody like Agatha, whom he found intelligent, humorous, splendid, and above all, sympathique. In this relationship, she was the grown-up, he the troubled and unhappy party who sought reassurance. "Of course, he isn't really adult like you," Agatha wrote to Max. But something in Stephen's vulnerability may have reminded her distantly of the early days of her courtship by Archie Christie, when he had loved her soothing voice and sweetness. Agatha and Stephen became friendly because both were alone. His wife Ethel and the two daughters he adored were in Canada, so he and Agatha began to see a good deal of each other. In 1941, she dedicated 5 little pigs to him. From overseas, Max gave his blessing to Agatha's new friendships with his old colleagues. How nice of Stephen and the Smiths, Sydney, not Sydney with a Y, to have been so kind, he wrote in August 1942. In fact, they were not being kind at all, but Max always had a slight air of condescension when imagining his wife in the sphere of academia. Clever pupa, he wrote, after she told him that she had caught out Sydney Smith in a conversation about free will. You had him nicely there. In 1942, Agatha went to hear Stephen lecture. "Didn't realize what an attractive voice he has," she wrote to Max. Then invited him to Greenway, which she was in the process of clearing. "Stephen seems to have reveled in Greenway," wrote Max. The two men were in regular contact, although occasionally Agatha had to push Max to write. "The one person you must keep up with is Stephen, Max. He really is very fond of you, and I think will be really hurt if you don't keep in touch with him. He's a sensitive person and minds all things, and he has been endlessly kind to me. Always tells me when he has heard from you and news about you."